Right, I brought my own PowerPoint thing with me today, but then I've transferred it to this computer, so it may not look as good as it once did, but unlucky. It's when you come to Yorkshire, you walk back in time, don't you? And just to be clear, because people think that I'm Scottish, as you can tell by my broad Scottish accent, I grew up in Halifax, actually. Grew up in Care in Halifax. I was actually born in Ireland. Spent most, about 10 years in Care in Halifax before I was converted, and then I have been around the world and now working in Scotland. So let me just explain what's happening. So the first session, I'm just going to give a broad overview of what I think the problems are when it comes to people living in schemes. Just so you understand, a scheme is the equivalent of a council estate in Scotland. And a huge proportion of the Scottish population live in housing schemes. I'm not quite sure of the figures in England, so I'm speaking from a Scottish perspective, okay? I'm not an expert, I'm not pretending to be an expert, but I'll set out some issues for you. And then in the first session, in the second session, I'm going to look a bit more practically at evangelism, why and how we should do evangelism. The third session is even more practical, since I've upset everybody in session one. Session three is more, how then can we grow leaders out of the situation? And then the final session is the Bible. So if you're sat by session two going, I've not heard much Bible out of this little fella, trust me, we'll have a little cheeky bit of the Bible at the end, okay? So my first question, I suppose, is what is poverty? We don't have to have a discussion, but what do you think it is like to be poor? What do we think of when we say the word poverty? Anyone can shout out anything.
Struggle,
okay.
Lack of money.
Deep, no hope. Deep thinkers in Yorkshire. So, I work in an area in a scheme in Scotland. This really is slow. You weren't wrong, were you, people? And is it not working now? So I work in an area in Scotland that measures poverty according to this index. They measure poverty on these seven lines: employment, health, education, access to services, life expectancy, crime, and the state of housing. So if you fall, according to the Scottish index of urban deprivation, if you fall below the national average on any or all of those factors, you qualify as deprived according to the Scottish government. Okay? And there are some pretty appalling figures. So my scheme, Nidri, life expectancy of a man currently is 48, which puts us about 90th in the world. So don't just think that this stuff is all out in the two-thirds world. It's here, it's particularly in Scotland, and it's on our doorstep. Now, when the World Bank did a survey of poverty, so when we think of poverty, sorry, we tend to think of these sorts of places. These are favelas, council estates. When the World Bank did a survey on poverty, and they asked the question, these are some of the replies they got in 60 countries around the world. For a poor person, everything is terrible: illness, humiliation, shame. It's in Moldova. Guinea-Bissau, I feel ashamed when I stand before my family, I have nothing to feed them. Latvia, we cannot afford to invite anyone to the house. We feel uncomfortable bringing others, eating with others without being a present. We feel unhappy. When one is poor, she has no say in public. She feels inferior. We'll always be poor. Listen, there's a huge report out from the World Bank. You can access it online, World Bank Poverty Report. And it's interesting, when we in Western developed worlds think about poverty, we almost naturally think about resources. Almost instinctively, lack of money, lack of jobs, lack of education, lack of housing. We think in those terms. But the language used in the two-third world is very, very different. This is the language they use when it comes to thinking about poverty. And almost very few of those people who responded with an answer to do with practical resources, which is fascinating. Which goes to show there are huge worldview differences between the Western educated, in that sense, worldview, and the two-third world when it comes to this problem, okay? So people from financially richer nations often describe poverty in terms of a lack of money or resources. Obviously, some people are saying hopelessness. That's not true, but largely, if I did this survey in pretty much anywhere in the UK, I'd get the same general answers, okay? But people from poorer, financially poorer nations often describe poverty in terms of how they feel and what their experience is. So it's fundamentally important that we get to grips with our basic understanding of poverty within the church if we're going to make any real lasting difference in the lives of those around us. How we answer, how our churches answer, how Christian organizations answer in the West now, how we answer the question of poverty will determine how we move forward in terms of outreach. Do you see the point? It always does. Our presuppositions will lead us down a path. And our presuppositions matter about poverty because they will affect, and they have affected in this country for the last 50 years, how we largely do ministry to the poor. Okay? So, if then in our worldview, we think like this. If we think poverty is a lack of knowledge, what do? We invest in schools, none of these things are wrong. I'm just trying to get us to trace a line of thought. If we think poverty is a lack of knowledge, we'll educate the poor. If we think it's oppression by powerful people, we'll work for social justice. That's very passe right now, right? In evangelical circles. If we think it's about personal sin, you know, where the reform camps stand, come on, boys. We will evangelize and disciple the poor, pretty badly often. If we think it's a lack of material resources, we will give material resources to the poor. So here's the problem in the UK, and I'm talking about Scotland largely from my experience of the last 10 years. And just so you know, I've been in ministry since 1999, and I've spent them in inner city Birmingham, Brazil favelas, and the schemes of Scotland. So I'm not an expert, but I've been doing ministry for 17 years in poor communities. So I have a little bit of insider knowledge. The problem in many circles, Christian circles today, is we are responding, when we are, to poverty and social issues in ways that aren't actually helpful to those on the ground. Because all our presuppositions are wrong. So if we misunderstand poverty, if we misunderstand what it is as rich Westerners, then we are going to more than likely misdiagnose how to handle it. You see the follow? The problems of council estates and housing schemes and favelas and, you know, bayous and all the other places around the world, these are not going to be solved easily. They're not going to be solved, are they, by two-week mission team trips and children's breakfast clubs. Not that these things are unhelpful, because I always get told off for being mean to people. So a doctor can make two mistakes when we are sick. They can only treat the symptoms of the condition rather than the underlying cause, or they can misdiagnose us altogether. In both cases, we don't get better, do we? In fact, we might even get worse. And I'm saying, largely, we blow all the smoke and mirrors away, largely, the same is true and has been true in our efforts to help the poor on our doorstep, particularly in Scotland. And I'm guessing the UK. If we only treat the symptoms of poverty and social issues, or if we misdiagnose the root cause of poverty, we actually hurt the poor, no matter how well-intentioned our efforts are. So what we need is a broader biblical framework for poverty. Or can I recommend a book? I'll recommend a couple of books to people. Brian Fickert, F-I-K-K-E-R-T, has written a book called When Helping Hurts. Hand up if you've heard of that book. A few. That's a brilliant piece of work, When Helping Hurts. He runs a thing called the Chalmers Institute in the US. He's looking mainly at the problem of short-term mission teams and the cause and effect in America. But his work on having a biblical worldview of poverty is excellent. And there's also another book, and I forget the author. It's called something. Toxic Charity. And if you've heard of Toxic Charity. And that's, again, it's not... The problem we've got is we're trying to extrapolate thinking in this field into the local church because the local church is so far behind. We'll get onto Mercy Ministry in a minute. And so they're very few. But those two books will at least help you get you thinking. How can we help those in our communities that are needy without hurting them? That's a big question. And I think far too many churches are hurting the poor, and I don't think they're doing it out of bad intentions or godless intentions. But we'll get onto that in a minute. So, let's have a cheeky look at a framework. If we think before the fall, the Lord created four foundational relationships for the human race. My smiley face looks a bit scary, really, doesn't it? I want you to know that I didn't do the smiley face. I never smile, so I would have been... Before the fall, we're created for relationship with God, obviously, our primary calling, to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. Pre-fall, basic Genesis stuff here. We were created for relationship with self. And what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is each of us were created to reflect and bear the image of God in a personal way. We're not evolved beasts, are we? We are image bearers of Almighty God. Thirdly, we were created also to be in relationship not only with God and peace within ourselves as image bearers, but in relationship to other people. We were made for community. And finally, we were made to relate to creation. Genesis 1, 28 to 30, in terms of the creation mandate still stands. We are called to be stewards of the Lord's creation. And so when the human race functions properly within these four foundational relationships, we experience true peace in our lives. If you want to go all Tim Keller, we experience true biblical shalom. That's the meaning in the sense of that word. Pre-fall, okay? But obviously the fall came, and look, there's the fall. And that affected all of these areas. So we see that everything now is broken. The relationship between God and the human race is obviously broken. With people denying the existence of God, denying His authority, etc. We have... The poverty of being, what I mean by that is instead of being image bearers, the result of the fall is we become mini gods, don't we? We run our own lives, do things our own way, leave God far behind. That affects poverty of community, self-centeredness, exploitation, abuse of others, you know, the list goes on. And obviously, our relationship to the stewardship of creation, loss of a sense of purpose, laziness, or workaholic, take your pick, right? Materialism, again, the ground is cursed. So as one thinker has said this, poverty then, when we think about it broadly, and I've got an hour to whip through everything. If you want to read this stuff really in depth and get to grips with it from a missiological perspective, pick those couple of books up and you'll really start to engage with this stuff. But poverty... is the result of relationships that do not work, that are not just, that are not for life, that are not harmonious or enjoyable. Poverty is the absence of shalom in all its meanings. And this helps us. Why does this help us? Well, it helps us understand it like this. Poverty is not just a single issue problem with a single issue solution. So, a wealthy man with a large house and three cars is getting divorced. He and his wife no longer talk to one another. In biblical terms, with that model, that is a poor man, isn't it? Now, if you're a geezer from my scheme, he's not a poor man. He's a rich dude and he's got no problems. That's because we're largely, you know, whiny, moany, victim mentality idiots. He's poor. He's poor in his relationships with others. Poor in his relationship with the Lord. Financially rich, obviously. But in most church terms, the guy with a large house, three cars, works every day, gives to the church, attends, and you don't know what's going on in his life, you wouldn't think of him as poor, would you? You wouldn't class him in the same way you would class a guy who popped in from your council estate. You see the problem that's going on? And it's going on both ways, by the way. Okay, I'm an equal opportunities offender. A mother's heart is broken. Her son's getting involved with drugs. Of course she's poor. Son poor in wisdom, poor in his relationship to the Lord, hurting the community. Families in a poor community, financially, decide to work together to do recycling in their area. They're poor financially, they're poor economically, but they're rich in terms of their relationship in community. Isn't that one of the most often when some of the young people go abroad and they go and serve somewhere financially poor, they come back and they'll always say, man, they had this real sense of community that we don't have, right? That's the richness that we don't talk about. A successful businessman, he's the Christian, works 7 days a week, has little time to spend with family or go to church. Gives a few quid though, and he's doing his best, right? Maybe he's a deacon or something. We'd never think of him as poor in a million years, and yet, biblically, poor all over the place, isn't he? He's economically wealthy, little time with his family, affecting his relationship with the Lord, with God's people. And so, and again, I'm making these very quick, because we can just then jump into the practicals. We are poor then, biblically, if there's a lack of harmony in these areas of our life. If there's a lack of, and I mean harmony in the biblical term of shalom, peace. If there's a disconnect between ourselves and the Lord. If we're engaged in personal sin in our life, however rich or poor we are, whatever car we drive, we're engaging in sin and we're not being the image bearers we ought to be. There's poverty there. And again, this may be economic poverty. Poverty is also not living wisely. Poverty is poor relationships with others. Poverty is a poor relationship with the Lord. So when we think of poverty, the starting point is not what have we got, what haven't we got. The starting point in the discussion is we're all poor. We're all broken. We're just broken in different ways. Is that making sense? That's got to be the starting point, because when we go in and we have, and we do, as seeing the poor as something to fix, because we have stuff that they don't have, that's where we create tension. We all need fixing. We all need the same person, don't we? We need Jesus Christ. So poverty, in the biblical sense, is a universal human condition. It knows no geographical, social, or financial boundaries. It may affect areas and people differently, but it affects everybody. That means when we think of poverty, think of this in every relationship. I am poor, they are poor. What are the areas? I don't know how many people in the room. I'll bet you all this right now. If, you know, Baptists did bet, but they don't. So I mean it metaphorically, brothers and sisters. Everybody in this room is broken. Or is affected by somebody who is broken. Or knows broken people. Correct? Okay. That's a beautiful thing, poverty, when we understand it biblically, because it's the great equalizer. It takes money out of the equation. I'm not saying it's not important, financial poverty, but from a biblical perspective, it equalizes the playing field. So let me encourage churches, if you're going into council estates or schemes or poor communities or supporting overseas missionary work in financially needy areas, please make sure that you are not going in looking to fix everything. Because we are as much in need of fixing as everybody else. So being on mission means simply this, saying to people, you're not okay, I'm not okay, but Jesus can fix both of us. We must be careful when we're coming in to particularly economically poorer areas, that we are coming in with the good news of the gospel of Jesus and not with the idea, even if it's not spoken, if it's implicit, that we are better than others. And the problem has been, in much of the UK and further afield, that we have entered with very faulty assumptions on poverty and how we ought to tackle it. That's been the problem. That's been the problem of Scotland of the last 50 years. We're going to have to rethink pretty much just about everything at the local church level about what we think about mercy ministry and what we do in terms of social justice. Because the problem that exists right now in our country, in very, very few churches are reaching housing schemes successfully. Very few. And I would imagine very few council estates as well. It's hard, long, difficult work. And I think that that's because the crossover between the existing church and our communities is going like that. Not because there's something wrong with the gospel. There's nothing wrong with that at all, in fact. But the problem is, where ministries do exist in these communities, it's often doing us more harm than good. So, let me tell you how the international community, or the international aid and development community, divide mercy ministry. This is how they do it. It's a standard practice. So they divide mercy ministry into these three areas. Is it three areas? It's three areas. So relief. So let's take, the tsunamis. One of the tsunamis came. What happens? Do we sit about having a debate going, do you think we ought to give them the Bible or some bread? What do you think? We don't sit about debating that, do we? We get out there. We make sure they get relief, immediate relief to a catastrophic situation. There's a problem. People need relief. Yes? And so in a situation requiring relief, the material are poor, are unable to help themselves because of the crisis. They need temporary immediate aid. Relief is only appropriate after a natural man-made crisis plunges people into a downward spiral. You know, medical emergencies, etc., etc. Now, the second stage of international development is called rehabilitation. And so in rehabilitation, people participate in returning their lives to pre-crisis conditions, contributing to improving their own situation. People participate. Okay? So there's a crisis. It's mental. Get out there. Let's get some emergency aid. The crisis dissipates somewhat. What's left on the ground? How do we go about helping whoever, the community, whoever it is, building back, or at least trying to return to what it was before as best as possible? That's the second stage. The third stage is development. People participate in improving their lives beyond what they've seen before, experiencing reconciliation in the four foundational relationships, okay, etc., etc., etc. By the way, if you want these notes, I can email them in full to whoever wants to write their name down at the end for what they're worth. Okay? Now, here's the problem. Christians and churches mimic. They mimic this stuff. Mercy ministry. If you read anything, hands up if you read Generous Justice. Anything on mercy ministry? Yeah. Christians mimic a lot of what's going out in the international aid and development agencies, and that's not a bad thing. It's not a criticism. Here's the problem. The problem at local church level is many Christians don't recognize these distinctions. And so they're providing relief to people in poor communities that actually need rehabilitation. And in some cases, development. And so by giving handouts to low-income people who are capable of helping themselves, churches and ministries contribute to the materially poor sense of shame and undermine their capacity to work. In fact, many of our nation's schemes, it's worse than that. Because we're not like the two-thirds world. We'll take your hand out because we've got no shame. And we'll screw you and the system because that's what we deserve. Right? That's the reality on the ground. You can read some nice, airy-fairy thing that makes you all feel better. We will screw you. And it's as simple as that. And many churches are getting screwed. Because there's nobody more gullible than a nice Christian with a social conscience. And here's the problem with churches, particularly in Scotland. It's why it's left us decimated. Is that many of the mercy ministries that have operated out of this sort of relief mindset have been doing so for decades and decades and decades after people should have moved on. And let me use myself as an example. So, I was on the streets at 2 years old. I was homeless. Literally on the street. I grew up in care all my life. All over Yorkshire. All over England. I was on the streets at 12. And full-time on the streets from the age of 15. I was a little man syndrome, right? You know what I'm talking about, Lee. And you, Lewis. In fact, what is it with this little gig? It's like the little man's gig, is it? Just sort of worked that out. So I feel like a giant among men right now. So.
It's a villain,
take it. I know, I'll take it. Take all I can get. So, I grew up on the streets. I know the streets. Across most cities, I could find where to get breakfast, where to get dinner, where to get me tea, where you could get a shower, where you could get clothes. You know, they were like pubs, homeless shelters. You know, you had your favourite, hang out with your pals, I'll meet you at so-and-so later. And those of us who lived within the subculture, and it is a subculture, we knew all the good spots, the good places, the times, this, the that, the other. We knew when the doors opened, when they closed, we knew who had the good stuff, we knew who had the bad stuff, we knew who asked the hard questions, we knew who didn't. We knew who we could intimidate. We knew everything. We had it mapped, okay? Now, churches were particularly good because people are generally nice in church, right? Because that's what Christiany people do. They just be nice to people. And they'd be kind to you. And they were also severely less savvy than the government agencies. Government agencies are they're old warriors. Yeah, they don't care. But a nice Christian who's just looking to give you a tract and a hug, they're brilliant. And, we would go in, you sit, you got your Christiany thing, you listen to someone give a nice talk and hand you a tract and you take your cup of tea, the silent exchange, we called it. And, you know, it's a bit like if you handle it like a job centre interview. You know, did this, did that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You got some stuff? Yeah, I've got some stuff. I'll take your stuff. That's brilliant. See you next week. And we're laughing, and although I didn't realize it at the time, these places were basically, indirectly, inadvertently funding my entire drug habit and my spiral into crime. Why? I didn't have to work. I didn't have to earn any money to eat. I didn't have to do jack, because I could go here, sorted. Now, over time, government cuts, which is not just a new invention, by the way, closed a lot of all the established hangout joints. And so we became more reliant on the God Squad. And again, you know, chat. But generally, Christians are easily placated. Tell them a sad story about something sad that happened to you. Cry a bit, you get what you want. And I sound cynical, and maybe I'm not cynical. These are the facts. Okay? They get to say the God bit. I get to get what I want. Everybody went home happy. They got to go home and share at their small group or something about how they helped a poor person. You know, I got to go and share at my small group about how I screwed a gullible person. Everybody sharing, right? Now, 20 years on, working across the world, on the other side of the table, if you like, I can say it like that, I'd like to say that things have changed, but it hasn't. The poor are still with us. Somebody famous once said something about that. Didn't quite catch his name. And the need for food banks and soup kitchens are probably greater now than for a generation, right? And the evangelical Christian world has been an explosion of interest in mercy ministries and helping the poor. And I sit in conferences and listen to, you know, guys with tight jeans and slick hair talking about doing generous justice. And time and again, I'm running into Christian leaders or organizations who are saying that they've opened a food bank or a soup kitchen, and it's transformed them. It's transformed my church, Mez. How much time have I got? Because I want to get this offensive bit out of the way, then I get down. Or even better now, and this one really winds me up, in the missional mindset, they've joined a secular soup kitchen so that they can, one, serve the poor in their city, and two, witness to unbelievers about their good deeds at the same time. As if helping the poor is somehow some clever evangelistic strategy. We find that one particularly offensive, by the way. Don't mistake scruffy looks and baggy eyes with stupidity. We know when we're being used. And much of the chatter in this sort of scene right now is, well, it's brought people together, or it's transformed the community, or whatever. So the reality, I fear, is somewhat different once the hype dies down. The people it usually brings together are generally fringe Christians or older people who've found something that is good, it's kind, it's fulfilling. But communities, poorer communities financially, are not being transformed. And in fact, in Scotland, I'm just about to spend a year on a PhD researcher to research into this whole area. And I'm trying to talk some Christian-y people in the UK to do the same, because this is fascinating, the relationship between churches' mercy ministries and what's happened over the last 20 years. Has there been any noticeable effect, and what are the issues? We need to really seriously be thinking about it. Certainly the unchurched are being reached, there's little doubt about that. But most people aren't worshipping on Sundays. Most guys that I know, we weren't ungospeled, we weren't saved. But we knew that, you know, give me a 5 minutes in a room with a Christian, I know the drill. In fact, many of them probably have a far intimate knowledge of the gospel than half of our members do. And so what's happening is far too many churches, instead of being a hindrance, help to the gospel, are a hindrance. We are guilty of paternalistic outreach, often wrapped up in the guise of a successful ministry. And what I mean by that is, a successful ministry is gauged by, well, you know, 50 people turned up this week for a parcel and most of them stayed for a chat. And these ministries go on, often in perpetuity, in relief mode. Serving largely the same constituents, many of them never moving on. Never motivated to move on. They're trapped and we are guilty of trapping them. Now, my phone rings every week without fail with some leader or another asking me for help. So the conversation will invariably go like this. Mez, we have got this man, woman in our church who's recently come to faith through our homeless work, soup kitchen, whatever. Feeling as applicable, right? Mercy ministry. The problem is, Mez, we don't know what to do with them. Can you help us? Because, you know, you're like a loser in a church full of losers, so what's one more? This is more exactly or less what happens with few variants. Herein lies the fundamental issue for many churches. Many churches' mercy ministries do not have a plan outside crisis intervention. So when I call for an, and I think we should call to an end to all mercy ministries tomorrow in evangelical churches, that one gets everybody really upset, is not to end them, but to make them better. Because we're looking at this like ostriches, getting all offended. You're saying we shouldn't help poor people. Look at me. Do I look like I'm saying that? Many of us are working in churches, if we are, without any real plan for how to disciple and equip people who are converted from our backgrounds. Serving them food once a week and giving them a parcel and being their pal and praying for them. Brilliant. That's one thing. Inviting them into your life, your home, your church, your family, and your community is a whole other thing altogether. Isn't it? The bottom line is that most churches just haven't thought through the long-term ramifications of their ministry to the poor. The really clever ones have worked this out. If I give my money to a parachurch organization, woohoo! They'll do the hard work for us. It is staggering to me, staggering, that many churches haven't thought through what they're going to do with somebody from a difficult or a council estate or scheme or whatever background who comes to faith through their mercy ministry. This guy said to me, I'm going to open a soup kitchen. A couple of guys the other day. I said, why? Well, what do you mean, why? Why are you going to open it? Well, to show the love of Jesus. Brilliant. What does that mean? What do you mean, what does that mean? Just like, be good to poor people and stuff. No, brilliant. Then what are you going to do? You're going to tell them about Jesus? We can tell them about the Lord. We can tell them the gospel. We can tell them the gospel. Then what are you going to do when... Funny thing, being a cheeky Calvinist that I am, I believe the gospel works. It's a funny thing, that. I believe that when you preach the gospel and the Holy Spirit draws people to himself and he opens their eyes and he brings them to salvation, that's actually a pretty good method, right? So I'm assuming in any ministry I engage with that the Lord's going to do that when the gospel's preached. So tell me, what are you going to do to disciple them? Other than just give them hymn books to hand out on a Sunday, are you? Or to set the chairs out? What is your strategy? Who's going to care for them? Who will hold them spiritually accountable? Who will look into their eyes and say, you are a bum? You're a bum. And the Bible says some things to say about you being a bum. Now you're a Christian, and I'm going to help you walk through that and put your life back together. All together. Not only will your relationship with God hopefully have been healed, but so will your relationship to yourself and to others and all the people you've damaged. That's what the gospel does, doesn't it? But how are we going to help them do that? What's our strategy? What's our plan? I believe that when God calls and saves people, our job as ministers is to prepare all God's people for works of service. Amen? I didn't invent that. I think God did. And here's my issue. What's your plan then? Great, I'm sure you've got a brilliant internship program for your postgrad. What's your plan for my guys? Here's the reality with Mercy Ministries in many of our churches. The reality is that the queue for parcels every Thursday or whatever is so long in many places that we do nothing more than dole out and get to the next person. Because the need is massive, right? We don't really get that much quality time. We get the brief chat, the brief conversation, the brief bit of encouragement. Those who really do need the food, by the way, are embarrassed to be there. You know, because don't get me wrong, they're out there. The ones who really need the help, they don't stick around for long enough. Because all the regulars know when to get there. And they're quite intimidating. And so soon we get into routines in these ministries over time. You hear the same tired old stories, don't you? Regurgitate. Trust me, if you've not been in it for as long as I have, you do. And then people just get... Don't think I'm cynical, because I'm not. I'm soft-hearted. Hear me, I am. Because I see Christians get tired after a bit, 1 or 2 years, and they're like, they're all liars, aren't they? They get all cynical. Nothing worse in the world in a church's mercy ministry than a regular. And I hear guys celebrating it. I've got regulars in ours. We've got, you know, same five or six guys every week, and they come. I'm like, they shouldn't be there 5 years later, should they? That's depressing. It's a travesty. I repeat, often people are not being moved on. They're not being helped. They're not, horror of horrors, being challenged to help themselves, largely out of a middle-class guilt complex, which actually often underpins most volunteering in this sector. But here's my thing. Church leaders, we need a plan. We need a plan bigger than crisis management every week. We need a plan to share the gospel. We need a plan to see people come to faith, be discipled, trained, equipped, and sent back out. How many mercy ministries do you know with that clear plan, identified, written down, and being executed? Or how many have gone from soup kitchen to pastor? Or soup kitchen to meaningful employment? The honest answer is not many. There are a few happy tales, of course there are. You know how many millions a year in our country go into this stuff? Ostriches we are. So here's my contention. What am I saying? I am saying, I'm not calling for an end to mercy ministries. I am calling for us to make them better. I'm calling for us to make them more biblical. I'm calling for them to be more reciprocal, harder for the recipient. I know I'm not a young Tory, in case you ask. Harder for the recipient. And we need to think of them as more, we need to think of mercy ministry as nothing more than a stepping stone on the road to serious Christian discipleship in our churches. And not as the ceiling, which it often is. My contention is this: Generous Justice is a great book. Mercy ministry is a great thing, but they don't go far enough. I was reached by a mercy ministry to the streets 20 years ago. There's a couple of Cullens out there, we'll remember that. We need to move on. We need to help people in my position move on. We need to be more than your token testimony giver at your church's outreach night. It's going to require... am I out of time? Someone's stopping me. Am I out of time?
Is that all right?
I've got a really posh word to say. I planned it. Deep breath. So... No, I'm not going to say it now. In your face, Lee. I'll leave them hanging. It's like the EastEnders theme tune. Do they watch EastEnders?
Thank you very much.